Hello, this is Corrine, and for the next hour, I'll be reading from the November 13th, 2025 issue of the Wall Street Journal on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. As always, thank you for joining us today. The highlights under business and finance are Atlanta Fed President Rafael Bostic said he would retire when his current five-year term expires at the end of February, avoiding a possible internal row over his reappointment. The Dow closed above 48,000 for the first time, rising 0.7%, while the S&P 500 gained less than 0.1%, and the NASDAQ fell 0.3%. Government reports on inflation and the labor market for October are likely never to be released, the White House press secretary said. The FTC is investigating whether proxy advisory firms Institutional Shareholder Services and Glass Lewis violated antitrust laws through their business of guiding shareholder votes on contentious topics. Chevron said it aims to bring online by 2027 a power plant that would serve an artificial intelligence data center in the West Texas shale patch. Foxconn said it expects a strong year ahead as AI computing demand continues to soar, and said it would collaborate with OpenAI. Coinbase plans to leave Delaware and reincorporate in Texas, where it views the legal framework as more predictable and efficient. Some U.S. life insurers are parking more than half the fixed income assets they need to fund policies and annuities in hard-to-trade debt. Private equity firm Clear Lake will acquire Pathway for almost $1 billion in a deal that will roughly double its assets under management to $185 billion. Now for the key articles under the Worldwide section. Trump signed a spending package to reopen the government, a measure passed by the House after a record 43-day shutdown. Democrats released new emails from Jeffrey Epstein in which the late financier discussed Donald Trump, prompting Republicans to accuse Democrats of cherry-picking and to release 20,000-plus pages of other Epstein documents. Democratic Representative Aldelita Grijalva of Arizona became the crucial 218th lawmaker to sign a bipartisan petition to force a House vote to release the files, putting her name down moments after she was sworn into office. The IAEA hasn't been able to verify the status of Iran's near-weapons-grade uranium stockpile since Israel and the U.S. struck Tehran's nuclear sites in June. Novartis said that a potential new treatment cured more than 99% of malaria cases in a late-stage study. Trump asked Israel's President Isaac Herzog to pardon Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who is on trial for corruption. Herzog condemned what he called a shocking and serious attack by Jewish settlers against Palestinians in the West Bank. Two of Ukraine's top ministers resigned amid an investigation into allegations of corruption in the country's energy sector. John F. Kennedy's grandson, Jack Schlossberg, said he would run for the House next year to fill a seat in New York City. The picture on the front page shows a man holding a penny in his hand, and below that is a dish of blank copper future pennies and the mold used to print it or stamp it. And that caption reads, "Sense and Sensibility." The U.S. Mint in Philadelphia struck the last pennies Wednesday. The coin, produced since 1793, now costs 3.7 cents to make and is being eliminated to save money. Above the blank coins and the die for the last batch. In that headline, after 232 years, the U.S. is down to the last penny. Longest shutdown ends as funding is signed. The deal extends federal operations through January 30th, puts off healthcare decision. By Katie Stack-Ferrick, Olivia Beavers, and Richard Rubin. Washington. President Trump signed a spending package to reopen the government late Wednesday, a measure passed by the Republican-led House after a record-long 43-day shutdown. The vote by the House was 222 to 209, largely along party lines. The package extends funding for the federal government through January 30th and includes full-year funding for the Agricultural Department, military construction, and the legislative branch. The bill also includes language guaranteeing the reversal of federal layoffs that the Trump administration initiated during the shutdown in a move to pressure Democrats, as well as a moratorium on future cuts. The resolution of the standoff ensures paychecks for federal employees, including air traffic controllers, and sends hundreds of thousands of furloughed government workers back to the job. But it postpones until later this year the central political fight, how to address the expiration of health care subsidies that are set to be cut off for millions of households. House passage on Wednesday came 2 days after the Senate approved the measure. A band of senators who caucus with the Democrats broke with the party to advance the package Sunday night amid deepening worries about the impact of the shutdown on low-income Americans and air travel, and little evidence that Trump or Senate Republicans would blink first. Final Senate passage came on a 60-40 vote Monday. House Speaker Mike Johnson, Republican from Louisiana, who had kept the House out since mid-September to keep up pressure on Democrats, then ordered House lawmakers back to Washington. After the vote, Johnson called the shutdown utterly pointless and foolish, and blamed Democrats for the hardship it caused. Voters are going to remember which political party played games with their lives, he said. Democrats had insisted for more than a month that any deal to reopen the government include an extension of Affordable Care Act subsidies, saying the GOP was making health care unaffordable. Some Republicans were sympathetic to the demands because over 20 million people get the tax credits to lower the cost of their health plans and are set to see their premiums rise sharply next year. Trump, a Republican, and party leaders said they would only negotiate after the government was reopened. Senate Republican leaders ultimately promised to hold a vote on ACA subsidies by mid-December. Trump signed the bill in a late-night ceremony from the Oval Office, surrounded by GOP lawmakers. Today, we are sending a clear message that we will never give in to extortion, he said, repeating his call for Republicans in the Senate to eliminate the filibuster to lower the 60-vote threshold for passing most legislation. Democrats' failure to extract concessions in the shutdown mirrored past standoffs, when the party that initiates a standoff seldom gets major wins. The shutdown, which began October 1st, furloughed hundreds of thousands of federal workers and required others to work without immediate paychecks. The lapse in funding led to delayed flights, threatened food benefits for millions of households, closed museums, and limited national park access. Pausing spending doesn't end up saving money for the government. A bipartisan 2019 Senate report found that shutdowns cost the U.S. more than $300 million. Epstein emails cite Trump as both parties release files. Democrats' disclosure prompts the GOP to put documents on disgraced financier. By Khadija Safdar and Joe Palazzolo. Democrats released new emails from Jeffrey Epstein, in which the late financier discussed Donald Trump, prompting Republicans to accuse Democrats of cherry-picking and to release 20,000-plus pages of other Epstein documents. The emails initially released by Democrats include a 2011 exchange between Epstein and his longtime associate, Ghislaine Maxwell, years after Epstein and Trump had a falling out, as well as messages with journalist Michael Wolff in 2019 while Trump was in the Oval Office. In the April 2nd, 2011 email, Epstein wrote to Maxwell, "I want you to realize that that dog that hasn't barked is Trump. Redacted names spent hours at my house with him. He has never once been mentioned. Police chief, etc." Maxwell responded that same day, "I've been thinking about that." The White House and House Republicans said the redacted name was Virginia Giuffre, and accused the Democrats of selectively leaking emails to smear President Trump. The emails were turned over to Congress by Epstein's estate. Epstein died in jail in 2019 after he was arrested on federal sex trafficking charges. The unnamed victim referenced in these emails is the late Virginia Giuffre, who repeatedly said President Trump was not involved in any wrongdoing whatsoever and couldn't have been friendlier to her in their limited interactions. White House Press Secretary Karoline Leavitt said in a statement, "The fact remains that President Trump kicked Jeffrey Epstein out of his club decades ago for being a creep to his female employees, including Giuffre." Giuffre, one of Epstein's most prominent accusers, died by suicide earlier this year. Giuffre alleged that Maxwell recruited her as a teenager, working at the Mar-a-Lago spa in 2000, and that Epstein trafficked her to other men. Giuffre said in a 2016 deposition that she never saw Trump participate in any abuse and didn't accuse Trump of any wrongdoing in her memoir, Nobody's Girl, published this year. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the Wall Street Journal on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. FBI's Kash Patel takes a wild ride. Trips on the bureau jet and loose talk put him in the hot seat with his bosses. By Sadie Gurman, Aruna Viswanatha, Josh Dossey, and Jack Gillum. On Halloween morning, FBI Director Kash Patel had a big announcement to make. The FBI thwarted a potential terrorist attack, he said in a 7:32 a.m. social media post that referenced arrest in Michigan. There was one problem. No criminal charges had yet been filed, and local police weren't aware of the details. Two friends of the alleged terrorist in New Jersey and Washington State caught wind of the arrest and moved up plans to leave the country, according to court documents and law enforcement officials familiar with the investigation. Justice Department leaders complained to the White House about Patel's premature post, saying it had disrupted the investigation, administration officials said. In his 9 months on the job, Patel has drawn flack from his bosses in the Justice Department and from his underlings at the Federal Bureau of Investigation, where he has fired dozens of agents deemed hostile to Donald Trump or to conservative ideas. But the Halloween announcement wasn't the biggest controversy to envelop the director that week. Patel hit the news for taking an FBI plane to attend a wrestling event where his girlfriend, a country western singer, performed, and then to her home in Nashville. A former FBI agent, Kyle Serafin, publicized the trip and called the taxpayer-funded travel in the middle of a shutdown pathetic. After that, Patel visited a Texas hunting resort called the Boondoggle Ranch, according to flight records and people familiar with the trip, which hadn't been previously reported. Patel's travel has frustrated both Justice Department officials who complained to the White House about it, and the White House itself, which had told cabinet officials in writing to limit their travel, particularly if it was overseas or unrelated to Trump's agenda, according to an administration official. Details about Patel's trips to visit his girlfriend and an August trip to Scotland have been passed around the White House in recent days, officials said. The FBI director is required to take the Bureau's private plane instead of commercial flights in order to have access to secure communications. If the travel is personal, the director is required to reimburse the government for the cost of a commercial flight, typically far less than the actual cost of private jet use. Patel has defended his travel, dismissing his critics as clickbait haters. A spokesman for the Bureau said the director has taken only about a dozen personal trips since assuming the role in February and had taken steps to cut down on travel cost. In a written statement, Patel said the Bureau has achieved historic success on violent crime and drug trafficking. Thankfully, Americans can see through the Wall Street Journal hot garbage. This FBI has never been stronger, he said. President Trump himself has occasionally expressed irritation in private with his FBI director, but continues to support him, a senior administration said. noting that Patel meets with Trump every 2 or 3 weeks. AI firm in China accessed NVIDIA's top chips by Liza Lin and Stu Wu, Jakarta, Indonesia. President Trump made clear this month that he doesn't want NVIDIA selling its most advanced artificial intelligence chips to China. But inside a tall, windowless building in Indonesia's capital, about 2,300 of those chips are ready to do work for a Chinese AI company. A Wall Street Journal investigation traced how a chain of deals across several countries got the chips inside the data center. A company that arranged the transaction is a subsidiary of a Chinese business on a U.S. trade blacklist. Despite U.S. rules intended to stop China from accessing the tech industry's most coveted hardware, there is no evidence to suggest the deals violated U.S. law. Some former and current U.S. national security officials said the U.S. should review deals such as the Jakarta one. NVIDIA and other tech companies argue for fewer export controls, saying it is better to have the rest of the world hooked on U.S. technology and financing U.S. innovation. The U.S. and China are in an arms race over AI, which can deliver military and economic advantages. The U.S.'s edge is that the world's top AI chip company, NVIDIA, is based in California. Since 2022, China has been barred from buying the most advanced U.S. semiconductors. NVIDIA's chief executive, Jensen Huang, recently said NVIDIA's market share in China has fallen to zero from 95% owing to U.S. export restrictions. But Chinese companies and organizations still use NVIDIA products. Some bring the chips physically into China using middlemen. Another increasingly popular workaround is renting computing power abroad and bringing data out of China and back, sometimes by packing suitcases with hard drives, the journal has previously reported. In the Indonesia case, the journal was able to trace the chips from start to finish. U.S. technology is being made available to a Chinese company through these four steps. Number one, chip sales. NVIDIA sells many chips to partners that build servers for AI computing. One partner that makes these servers is Silicon Valley-based Aeves. Its parent is one-third owned by Inspur, a Chinese tech company. Number two, Indonesian buyer. In the mid-2024, people familiar with the matter said Aeves began negotiating a deal with a cloud computing business in Indonesia. Number three, Chinese customer. Indosat bought the servers only after securing a client with Aeves' help, some of the people said. That customer is Shanghai-based AI startup INF Tech. Number four, finance and health. As of October, the servers have been delivered and were being installed, one of the people said. When operational, the person said, they will focus on helping INF train AI for financial applications and science research. Lawyers familiar with the export control rules said, so long as a Chinese company isn't using the chips to help China with military intelligence or weapons of mass destruction, the arrangement comports with U.S. export controls under the Trump administration. Harvard frets, A's aren't what they used to be, by Roshan Fernandez. Students have bashed and bemoaned the Harvard report on grades. Cambridge, Mass. The last time Jake Kamnikar remembers receiving anything other than an A on his transcript was in third grade art class. He is now a freshman at Harvard. That streak could end soon. A recent internal report found that Harvard is dishing out too many A's and that the current system for undergraduates is failing to perform the key functions of grading and damaging the academic culture of the college more generally. The report prompted uproar from some Harvard students who said they already study a lot, sleep very little, and face immense stress to perform academically. Many feel they worked hard to get into Harvard only for the school to contemplate moving the goalpost. You admitted these students because they have straight A's, and now you're getting a lot of A's, and it's like, this is a problem? And I'm thinking, how on earth is that a problem? Said Summer Tan, a Harvard senior. Harvard's report on its undergraduate college found that about 60% of grades were A's during the 2024-25 school year, a jump from about 25% in 2005-06. The median GPA upon graduation is now 3.83, up from 3.29 in 1985. The average time students spend studying outside class has barely changed, from 6.08 hours a week for each of their courses in the fall of 2006 to 6.3 hours this spring, according to the report by Amanda Claybo, Harvard's Dean of Undergraduate Education. New faculty reported surprise at how lenient grading is, and nearly all expressed serious concern about grade inflation. The report includes recommendations to curb grade inflation and restore rigor. There's a graph on the front page called Viewers Pay Up for Streaming. The menu of options for how to catch and watch shows and movies without cable continues to grow, as do their price tags. The price for select streaming services, the change since 2019. Disney Plus is up 172%. Apple TV up 160%, Peacock 120%, Hulu 58%, Paramount Plus 40%, Netflix 38%, HBO Max 23%. Toyota makes bet on hybrid production, by Christopher Otts, Liberty, North Carolina. Toyota, a longtime hybrid car and truck promoter, is making one of the industry's biggest bets on green transportation and opening a $14 billion battery plant here. For years, Toyota held out against electric vehicles while rivals retrofitted factories and launched models in preparation for an all-electric future. Now that the EV market in the U.S. is vanishing as tax credits expire and sales disappoint, Toyota is doubling down on its hybrid strategy. The Japanese automakers gamble that American consumers, many of whom won't touch an EV, will buy increasing numbers of hybrids, which often get up to 50% better mileage than a standard gas-powered car. Toyota also said it would invest up to $10 billion in U.S. manufacturing over the next 5 years, in addition to the North Carolina site, where it made the largest investment in a U.S. battery production site. The batteries that Toyota has begun making at the sprawling plant, located between the cities of Greensboro and Raleigh, are going into hybrids assembled in Kentucky and Alabama. The complex is designed to make batteries for EVs and hybrids, including those that plug in and travel short distances on just electricity before switching to gas. The North Carolina plant, Toyota's first battery production site outside Japan, will enable the automaker to continue its gas electric hybrid push in the U.S. while reducing shipping distances and avoiding tariff risk. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the Wall Street Journal on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. From the opinion pages, the CIA's battle with truth. Reconciliation might come if lies could be admitted without fear of prosecution, by Holman W. Jenkins, Jr. When journalist of the British Broadcasting Corporation, in a 2024 video, snipped Donald Trump's speech before the January 6 riot to remove his call for peaceful protest, then linked the remaining passage to words he spoke an hour later, calling on followers to fight, they had to have known what they were doing. Next, they showed the Proud Boys marching on the Capitol as if in response to Mr. Trump's instruction, though the Proud Boys' march had taken place before Mr. Trump spoke. Mistakes are made, a BBC official admits. The British public wasn't watching closely enough to notice or be fooled. These were lies by journalists to please themselves. I got a sense in the late 2016 watching a network panel show. To on-air personalities, Mr. Trump was a gift they had been waiting for. A Republican so disreputable they could put words in his mouth with impunity, allowing them to strike triumphant gotcha poses. This week, two senior leaders of the British broadcaster stepped down over the actions described above, and a question naturally occurs. Isn't this pattern getting awfully old? If Trump's enemies, like former Obama CIA chief John Brennan, are now to be criminally prosecuted in the collusion hoax, at least it will be over events that actually happened. If some are charged with process crimes, such as lying to investigators, at least it won't be the direct result, as it was for Trump associates, of investigations spawned by manufactured evidence. And it's already clear today's defendants will get a much more sympathetic version of due process from courts and judges than Trump defendants got. But criminal prosecutions also won't produce truth and reconciliation, to borrow the title other countries have used for air-clearing inquiries designed to allow the truth to be acknowledged by exactly those with the least personal, reputational, and institutional incentive to acknowledge it. This approach is liberating. It solves what I might call the Brennan problem, which afflicts officials who might otherwise have to spend their natural lives ducking and weaving about what they did in office. Indeed, Because disinformation is part of Mr. Brennan's profession, he might have been expected already to have obliquely acknowledged the CIA's contribution to spreading false claims about Mr. Trump while still hanging onto a belief in the righteousness of its motives. Except for a problem. It's not the disinformation he and allies may find hard to admit. It's the incompetence, the BBC-like incompetence. Like the BBC, in fact, their acts look competent only if their goal was to serve up a big win for Mr. Trump, to validate him, and to discredit themselves. Then their method makes sense. Attaching themselves repeatedly to fake evidence destined to be exposed as fake. The Steele dossier, the fabricated evidence of FBI lawyer Kevin Kleinsmith, the lies about Hunter Biden's laptop. At the start of it all, the flimsy Russian intelligence that FBI Chief James Comey seized upon to justify improper acts in the Hillary Clinton email case, which likely ended up causing Mr. Trump's victory in 2016. Mr. Trump, I'm guessing, sees criminal prosecutions as counter-programming for the impeachments to come. For the rest of us, the results can only be bad. Truth and Reconciliation aims to make it no longer socially acceptable or personally necessary to lie about events everyone knows took place. Unfortunately, this doesn't work when the press itself is party to the cover-up. Indeed, somewhere in his mind, Mr. Brennan must be thinking, if not for so willing and compliant and credulous a media, we would never have ventured as far and disastrously down this road as we did, which only worked to Mr. Trump's benefit. It's an argument I've been making since May 2017, when the real premise for Mr. Comey's actions in the Clinton case became known. Trumpers and anti-Trumpers should be united in pursuit of the truth. Mr. Trump and his supporters are rightly angry over government-sponsored lies. But anti-Trumpers should see that the results have only been perverse. The re-election of Mr. Trump, the untrammeled and retributive presidency he now exercises, hard to imagine if not for the serial lies and then their exposure of the Clinton, Obama, and Biden cabals helped along by a compromised news media. The absurdity only compounds itself. The need to protect past lies begets new lies. There can't be reconciliation when large interests are invested in not facing the truth. The biggest and longest lasting cost of this episode? Media figures and establishment media institutions who now go forward zombie-like, lying about what happened after 2016. Who knows what damage our country may yet suffer from this? Our generation has redefined the old slur, yellow journalism. Its new meaning, journalism by journalists who, in their personal cowardice and cravenness, deny their audiences the truth that their audiences are owed. Stupidity never shuts down. The government is set to reopen, but both parties are busy with foolish internal fights. By Carl Rove. The longest government shutdown in history, and one of the stupidest, is thankfully ending. But the political warring over stupid ideas is hardly over. Both sides are busy with foolish internal fights. In the past few weeks, Democratic congressional leaders insisted the shutdown was good politics for their party. The longer it went on, their argument ran, the more Democrats were likely to win the battle for public opinion. The leading advocate for the idea that the more Americans suffered, the better it was for Democrats was Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer. He told Punch Bowl News that every day we're getting better and better as the message sinks in more and more deeply. The pugnacious New Yorker wasn't alone. Senator Chris Murphy, Democrat from Connecticut, said that because of the shutdown, the Democratic Party looks powerful for the first time all year. While House Minority Whip Catherine Clark, Democrat from Massachusetts, said, "It is one of the few leverage times we have." Deciding that the shutdown with its misery and discombobulation was good politics wasn't the smartest call. Saying it out loud raised expectations that Democrats would prevail in their main demand, the extension of COVID-era Obamacare subsidies set to expire at year's end. Instead, seven Senate Democrats and Senator Angus King, independent from Maine, who caucuses with Democrats, voted with Republicans Monday to end the shutdown. This triggered a ferocious backlash among Democrats angry that they didn't win any concessions from the GOP after all. Many are calling for Mr. Schumer to resign as leader for this ill-fated stunt. Even after sweeping election victories last week, Democratic strategists say the party is back to disarray. But Democrats can comfort themselves that at least they aren't alone. Conservatives are likewise embroiled in bitter internal fighting over an idea even more stupid than Mr. Schumer's shutdown, dispatching the welcome wagon for Holocaust denier and white nationalist Nick Ferentes. Here's the context. Tucker Carlson, on his popular podcast For Populist, conducted a grotesquely sympathetic interview with Mr. Ferentes in late October. Mr. Ferentes had previously called Adolf Hitler cool, claimed the Holocaust was exaggerated, said rape is just so not a big deal, and asserted that white people have a special heritage and are justified in being racist. These views went unchallenged by Mr. Carlson, as did Mr. Ferentes' praise for Joseph Stalin. Instead, Mr. Carlson excoriated American supporters of Israel, particularly bashing Christian Zionists for their heresy. I was on the list of Israel supporters who he said suffered from a brain virus and whom he dislikes more than anybody. Soon after, the Heritage Foundation's president, Kevin Roberts, posted a video in which he said, "Mr. Carlson would always be a close friend of Heritage." He then castigated the venomous coalition attacking the populist media figure for interviewing Mr. Ferentes and urged conservatives to focus on our political adversaries on the left, not attacking our friends on the right. Mr. Roberts' actions have roiled Heritage and unsettled many on the right who once respected the foundation. Given that Mr. Carlson's journey into a vile and very weird world has been well documented, it's no surprise he'd treat Mr. Ferrante with kid gloves. But why did Mr. Roberts leap to Mr. Carlson's defense for playing patty cake with a neo-Nazi? The depressing reality is that the noxious notions of Messrs. Carlson and Fuentes, while nowhere near dominant on the American right, have been gaining in popularity. Views that a dozen years ago were rightly considered sick and bizarre, some now hope to bring into the mainstream. This should serve as a warning for conservatives. We've been too slow for too long to confront hate merchants seeking to infiltrate the right. We've allowed some conservatives to make alliances with loathsome figures and permitted destructive currents of thought to flourish without appropriately forceful criticism or reproach. We've looked the other way when conservatives said and did awful things. That's how political movements decay. It's past time that principled conservatives speak up and speak out for the sake of conservatism and the country. Another factor has fueled both the Fuentes debacle and the shutdown insanity: social media. Algorithms reward outrage and conspiracies with clicks and followers. They allow Mr. Fuentes' message of hate to reach millions from his suburban Chicago lair. And these sites seduce Americans with power and respect to say out loud stupid and sometimes vile things to please a loud and angry fringe. Such is the price of the polarized moment we find ourselves in, made worse by social media's allure. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the Wall Street Journal on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Why Schumer had to do it. Ordinary Democrats didn't demand a shutdown. Left-wing nonprofits did. By Barton Swaim. A government shutdown, as Claus Witz didn't quite say, is the continuation of politics by other means, or so we might conclude after the longest and most nakedly political shutdown in U.S. history. In raw political terms, it's conceivable that a majority of voters blame President Trump and the Republicans for the shutdown rather than the Democrats who literally precipitated it. Mr. Trump's omnipresence in American life makes anything wrong appear his fault, and the news media's pastel-colored portrayal of Democratic motivations reinforces that narrative. Even so, it's not exactly right to say Democrats charged into this idiotic controversy for political advantage. A more accurate term to describe their aim? Self-preservation. Some Democratic voters, no doubt, believe Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer blocked the Republicans' government funding resolution because he didn't want Obamacare exchange premiums to soar. Count me skeptical. The likely premium increases without the subsidies are significant but not apocalyptic, and certainly not worth the political risk of a five-week shutdown. Are we seriously to believe that Mr. Schumer and his party felt so strongly about pandemic year emergency funding that they were willing to crash the U.S. government to extend it? Come on. So why did the Democrats do it? From the beginning of the dispute, everyone seems to have understood that Mr. Schumer forced a shutdown because he needed to show his state's progressive voters that he could take it to Mr. Trump and so avoid a primary challenge from the left, perhaps from Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. The Senate leader's Democratic colleagues went along with the shutdown for a parallel reason. The whole stunt was about Trump's authoritarianism, wrote Ezra Klein of the New York Times on Monday. It was about showing their base and themselves that they could fight back. Jack Blanchard of Politico observed similarly that Democrats achieved their primary political objective, showing a furious base that they can actually work together effectively and are prepared to fight with every tool at their disposal. It was all for show, literally. But what or who is that base to which Messrs. Klein and Blanchard refer? Poke around and you'll find it consists mainly of cash-flush foundations, unions, and activist groups. The American Civil Liberties Union, the Sunrise Movement, and other environmental and climate groups, Planned Parenthood, and other abortion rights outfits, an array of immigrant rights organizations, some of them so radical as to be almost insurrectionist, the American Federation of Teachers and the National Education Association, the Southern Poverty Law Center, Black Lives Matter, and other racial justice organizations, the Human Rights Campaign, and assorted LGBTQ activist groups, scores of foreign-connected Palestinian rights and otherwise anti-Zionist organizations, the George Soros-funded network known as the Open Society Foundations, and on. The ganglion has no counterpart on the right. Republican office holders frequently dance to the tunes of nut job primary voters, and many have an unnatural fear of both online right-wing mobs and Mr. Trump, which is its own problem. But the Heritage Foundation, the Cook Network, and Turning Point USA have nothing like the influence over elected Republicans that left-wing nonprofits have over their Democratic colleagues. Harry Reid, when he led Senate Democrats in the 2010s, delivered many a diatribe about the Koch brothers' supposed hold on the Republican Party. And in 2016, the New Yorker's Jane Mayer published a fat book making the same allegation. Even as the GOP drifted away from the Koch's libertarian doctrines. The word for what Mr. Reid and Ms. Mayer engaged in is projection. The same sort of projection has led Senator Sheldon Whitehouse, Democrat from Rhode Island, to indulge in the delusion that the Federalist Society manipulates American society by some feudive scheme of money and influence. Why shouldn't he think so? That's the way things work in Mr. Whitehouse's world. Otherwise, smart liberals have for decades assumed that the gun lobby achieved its goals by big spending and covert bullying. In fact, gun groups, which contrary to liberal myth, spent less on lobbying than some other industries, only had power because millions of Americans backed their cause, which is pointedly not true of the radical groups currently pushing around Democratic lawmakers. Ordinary Democratic voters weren't clamoring for Mr. Schumer to shutter the government, just as they weren't outraged when he chose to keep it open in March. And go further back, rank-and-file Democrats didn't tell the Biden administration to keep the southern border wide open for 3 years. They didn't threaten to burn down the 2024 Democratic Convention because the president more or less took Israel's side against Hamas. Nor did they require liberal politicians to give squishy non-answers to questions about dudes playing in women's sports. These demands issued from progressive nonprofits led by ideologues and staffed by young busybodies. Liberal politicos frequently accuse Republicans of slavishly catering to the whims of Mr. Trump. There is truth in the charge, but Mr. Trump will leave office in 3 years. Progressive nonprofits aren't going anywhere. The Pepper and Salt cartoon shows a boss talking to two employees who are seated at a desk trying to think up new ideas. And the boss says, "Just think of yourself as mice. If the company doesn't bring in any cheese, you all starve." Another Pepper and Salt cartoon shows a young mother with a child pointing to a museum piece depicting Venus de Milo, which is the statue without arms. And she says, "See what happens when you bite your fingernails?" Letter to the editor, the topic, the injustice of a shutdown. Missed paychecks and food aid benefits and healthcare sticker shock boost the urgency for a breakthrough to end the government shutdown. There is plenty of reporting on the effect the shutdown has on the most vulnerable and the reality that many government employees are continuing to do their jobs without pay. Meanwhile, members of Congress continue to collect checks. I imagine resolution of the impasse would be hastened if our representatives had to bear the hardships they so freely impose on other Americans for political gain, or if their constituents realized how unjust this is. From Christopher Wolfe, Lexington, Massachusetts. You've been listening to a reading of articles and features from the November 13th, 2025 issue of the Wall Street Journal. We read from the Wall Street Journal every Monday through Thursday at 11 p.m. Your reader has been Corrine. Thank you for listening and have a wonderful weekend.
You're listening to the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. We broadcast daily readings of printed matter to those who are blind or have a print disability throughout Buffalo, Western New York, and Southern Ontario's Niagara Peninsula. Almost 40 years and more than 300,000 hours of radio readings to those without sight. Our broadcast signal is provided at no charge by WNET. Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service broadcast studios are at 1199 Harlem Road in Cheektowaga. Please let others know about your Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. For more information, call us at 716-821-5555.